This is Jim Engster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Paul Ehrlich, Stanford University scientist, biologist, and educator. He became well known in 1968 when he published a book called The Population Bomb. All these years later, 45 of them, he stands by his thesis that the human population is too large and is a direct threat to human survival and the environment of the planet. Also on the show, Moses Gates. His book is Hidden Cities. He has some information about hidden treasures in some of the world's great cities. We'll also hear from Michael Gurian in an encore appearance. Michael has some tips for a better life after the age of 50. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Paul Ehrlich. He's a biologist and educator and the Bing Professor of Population Studies in the Department of Biological Sciences at Stanford University and president of Stanford Center for Conservation Biology. Dr. Ehrlich is an expert on population in our world, and you believe that this poses a global ecological threat. How so?
Well, I think the entire scientific society has spoken out for that effect so many times it's dizzying. But a single point, I think most people in Louisiana understand the climate is changing and in very unhappy ways. And, of course, what we're seeing now is just a tiny foretaste of what's coming. And, of course, the more people you have, the more greenhouse gases automatically go into the atmosphere, and therefore the more rapid and more dangerous climate change will be, particularly with its impact on shores and, on more importantly, on the agricultural system, which is already staggering, and where we have between 1 and 3 billion people already undernourished, malnourished, and short of vital nutrients. So there is no question whatsoever, not the tiniest little hint of a question, that population growth and population size are two very important problems and very important drivers of the environmental problems that we're facing.
You have been writing about this for at least 45 years. In 1968, you wrote The Population Bomb. At the time, it was controversial. Do you feel vindicated all these years later?
Well, I don't feel vindicated because the vindication isn't the issue. Doing something about it is. In other words, the scientists live by the opinion of fellow scientists. And for all those years, although there has been controversy in the general public, there's been zero controversy in the scientific community. And I've had the full support of all of my colleagues and urging from them to continue to push the point. And they're all trying to push the point, too. So vindicated, I think more depressed, because It will take a long time to humanely deal with the population problem, and we haven't got a long time.
Well, you are stressing that we need to do something. What can be done?
Well, the quickest step is certainly to give every sexually active human being full access to modern contraception and, where necessary, backup abortion. And there are some scientists who believe that alone could solve a population problem and start start us towards a gradual decline in population size, which is absolutely necessary if we're going to be sustainable. Second thing is to give full rights to women everywhere. There's not a single country in the world where women have the same rights, opportunities, education, job opportunities, pay for work, and so on that men do. And we have a lot of evidence that when you do provide more rights to women, that the fertility rates go down and population growth slows or stops, so, or you even get the shrinkage. So the two basic things are treat women fairly, and that's going to take a while because it hasn't happened anywhere yet, and then make sure everybody has access to contraception when they're sexually active, and hopefully good contraception to make the abortion problem minimal.
Well, you say that abortion should be readily available. That's extremely controversial in the United States. Does the United States have issues that are independent of those from the rest of the world?
Well, we are worse in that aspect, probably, and more immoral than most countries. But, of course, there are restrictions on abortion many places. And, again, the scientific community knows what happens very clear, that when you make abortion illegal or difficult to get, you're killing women. And we have a whole bunch of state legislatures at the moment that are working very hard to kill women, because When children are unwanted, if the women can't get safe abortion, they move to quack abortion, which is dangerous and often kills them. So I can't think of few things in our society are more immoral than middle-aged and old men killing women by putting in ridiculous restrictions on the access to abortion. On the other hand, nobody likes abortion, and I think that the basic answer is to make sure that everybody has available to them very good, safe contraception, and that's another place where we're not doing a very good job.
Well, there are population deniers, I'm sure you're aware. Are they an important part of this discussion, or do they really count?
Well, they count in the sense that they block discussion of it. It's not, for instance, in Australia, at least there is public discussion all the time about the size of the Australian population, what should be done about it, and so on. So they do tend to damp discussion of the issue, which is certainly one of the critical issues of our time, and maybe the critical issue of our time. So to that extent, they have a very malign influence on the future of our children. What you got to remember is the issue really shouldn't be how many kids do I want. The question should be, what kind of world do I want my kid or kids to live in? We have not got the right discussion going in the United States. Sometimes I despair over whether we ever will. I mean, for example, President Obama is certainly fully aware of the issues of population, but does he dare say anything about it? Can any elected politician in the United States really take a strong stand on population control, even though one of the first duties of any government ought to be to make sure that the size of the population that's being governed is ideal for the health and welfare of the people in the population?
Well, do you suggest some kind of limit on the number of children people could have?
Well, I would not suggest that sort of Chinese approach to the problem until we've tried the things that everybody could agree on that are humane. In other words, what sensible person in our society doesn't want women to have absolutely equal rights, equal pay for work, and so on? What sensible person doesn't want any kid that's sexually active having all the protection from venereal disease and all the ability to limit his or her reproduction that we can possibly give them? So I would start there. If that doesn't work, then, of course, the issue becomes a public issue of how many people, is a sensible number for society, and what should society do about it? We're a small group animal living in gigantic groups, and one of the things that means is that not everybody can do all the things they want to do. Whether you, want to have 20 children, then you're basically saying in our society, I want to steal your resources. I deserve more than you can get. I mean, we're a resource-short society in which we're moving towards a collapse of the entire civilization by wrecking our life support systems. The number of people that we have are a major factor, one of the three major factors in wrecking our life support systems. And so when you want to have a large family, mm-hmm. What you're saying is, I don't care what happens to your children, grandchildren, or my children and grandchildren. I just want to have a lot of kids. And if that wrecks the world, well, so be it. It's my privilege to do so.
Well, the population on the Earth is, what, over 6 billion?
Over 7.
Over 7 billion.
It was when I was born, there were in 1932, there were 2 billion. When the population bomb was written, there were 3.5 billion. Now there's over 7 billion, and the prediction is that we'll add by 2050, which some of your listeners will doubtless still be alive, another 2.5 billion people. That is many 500 million more people than were alive on the entire Earth when I was born. Not all that long ago, in my view.
So what's a comfortable level as far as the Earth's population?
Well, we don't know for sure because it depends, of course, on what technologies we use and how much each individual consumes. But the most recent study that I've been involved in suggests that without drastic changes in how we do things how people live, that 1.5 or 2 billion people might be at a safe level for at least centuries. It's not clear. Some people claim that even that will be many too many in the long run, but at least that would be a start. So we're somewhere 3 or 4 times the sustainable size now, and moving towards being 5 or so times the sustainable size in the not-too-distant future.
We're visiting with Dr. Paul Ehrlich, Stanford University Bing Professor of Population Studies and entomologist by training, and he has been on the forefront of this population issue for about half a century. Now, you realize there is a religious component to this discussion as well. How do you get around people who have devout religious beliefs who believe that the Lord will take care of this?
Well, my personal view is we should live in an evidence-based world, not in a faith-based world. People, you know, there are people who devoutly believe the Earth is flat. There are people who devoutly believe that the mission to the moon was all faked. There are people who devoutly believe that the U.S. government was responsible for the 9/11 disaster. So you can't change people's beliefs very easily, but they're beliefs that are going to that will be changed for us. In other words, people who say, for example, it's been claimed that we can easily support 16 billion people. That was the Catholic bishops some years ago. Well, I'd say the same thing to them today that I would have said when people said in 1968 that we will easily support 5 billion people, feed them, house them, no problem. 3.5 is not too many, and we can easily support 5 billion. It's simple. I want to see them show me that they can support the people we have today, a decent life for everybody, a decent diet for everybody, not 1 to 3 billion people hungry, not 3 billion people living on less than $2 a day. When they do that, when they give everybody a happy, healthy, free life today, then I'll be happy to discuss with them what the utility might be of having even more people. But I'm sick and tired of having these claims about how many billion more people we can support when we don't support them decently today, where we're still a society racked not only with hunger in many parts of the world and misery, but also fighting over resources increasingly. And because the resources are getting ever scarcer, as Mike Clare demonstrates in his recent book, The Race After What's Left, we still are plagued with racism and sexism and economic inequality. So when we fix up the world with the 7 billion people we have now, then I'll be happy to talk about whether we should shrink or increase. But until we do a decent job of caring for people today, until everybody in the United States has a job, is not hungry, has access to education, access to good health care, access to good contraception and so on, I don't want to hear what people think about how easy it'll be to support many, many more people.
Well, the population bomb began with this statement: the battle to feed all humanity is over. In the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. At this late date, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate. That was written in 1968. As I stated, it was controversial for its time. All these years later, you could change the wording just a bit, and we would have the same discussion, and you're saying it's more cause for alarm now than it was 45 years ago.
Well, of course, one of the things that happened, thanks in part to the population bomb, is that we changed the way we handled the world's food system, and that saved a lot of lives, at least temporarily, although something on the order of 200 million people have starved to death since that was written. That is almost two-thirds of the population of the United States equivalent. And today, almost a billion people are hungry, and another 1 to 2 to 3 billion, depending on who you read, are micronutrient malnourished. So we're doing a lousy job of feeding people today. One of the main things that happened right after the population bomb was written is that Norman Borlaug and his colleagues developed ways of increasing food production, at least on a temporary basis, very rapidly, and that saved a lot of lives. What people tend, at least in the short term, what people tend to forget is that Borlaug, in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech around 1970, said this may buy us a few decades to deal with the population monster. And Borlaug was extremely concerned about the growth of the population and felt that at the very best, the Green Revolution would save some lives and give us a chance to solve the population problem. Well, in the short term, it certainly saved some lives. In the long term, it may have killed more people than it saved. But the basic point is we did nothing about the population problem. Fortunately, in some places like Europe, other factors led to a slowing of population growth and the start, in some places, of a population decline, which is precisely what we need in the rich nations. You got to remember, the U.S. is the most overpopulated nation in the world. It has got us the third largest in actual number of people, but when you calculate in how much each one of us consumes, we're the big population monster in the world, not China or India, although they are trying to compete with us for that happy title.
Well, thank you, Dr. Paul Ehrlich, Stanford University, Bing Professor of Population Studies, and we'll hopefully talk with you again.
Well, very nice talking to you. Thank you for the time.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest at this time is Moses Gates. He's an urban planner, licensed New York City tour guide, and visiting professor of demography at the Pratt Institute. And after moving to New York City and pursuing graduate studies in urban planning, Moses Gates began exploring hidden facets of the city, from visiting abandoned structures and disused subway stops to scaling the Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Williamsburg bridges. The more he experienced and saw, the more his thirst for adventure grew. And soon he was traveling to a dozen countries on four continents, and this is detailed in his book, Hidden Cities. Good morning, Moses Gates.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you have unearthed some treasures in places that we probably wouldn't think of as frequent tourist destinations.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that really everywhere can be a tourist destination. Everywhere, especially in cities, because I'm an urban planner, is interesting. You just sometimes have to dig a little deeper than you normally do.
Well, what's the most fascinating place you've been to?
So one of the really most interesting experiences I had was actually in Rome, where we were just kind of poking around the sewer system, you know, nothing big, going along in a 19th century collector drain that was right by the Tiber River, and there was a hole in the wall. We went up and into the hole in the wall, and it was like going back 2,000 years in time as we crawled along, because connected to this drain was this abandoned Roman, ancient Roman structure. It turned out to be, the archaeologists think it's a tannery, an old tannery underneath the Capitoline Hill. But it's really neat. Sometimes you can just encounter this amazing art or history just kind of by poking around the underground.
You like climbing bridges, don't you, Moses?
I haven't done it in a minute, but yeah, it was a good hobby.
Yeah. Now, in the United States, you've been around the U.S. as well. The Chrysler Building, you're fascinated with the Chrysler Building. Why?
Well, I love abandoned observation decks. I think it's the coolest thing. And here in New York City, we used to have about a dozen observation decks that were open to the public. Some were free, some cost a nominal amount. The Empire State Building has always been the big boy on the block and actually costs twice as much money as any other observation deck. But kind of slowly throughout the years, these were closed to the public. And it's a real shame. We have all these wonderful views of the city just right above our heads that are just kind of lost and forgotten. And one of those is the Chrysler Building that until 1945 had an observation deck open to the public, and it's just a beautiful, iconic building, and it would be really great if there was a way to open it back up.
Well, and when you're on that deck, what do you see? Well, what do you hear? What's it like?
So it's just amazing. So people ask me, like, what's the appeal of abandoned observation decks? And I tell them it's the same as an active observation deck. You know, here in New York, we get 2 million visitors a year to the Empire State Building. You know, ask them. So the Chrysler has a really neat view. It's right at the southern edge of Midtown, so you can kind of see the southern half of the southern part of the island of Manhattan all spread out before you. And then on the north end, you're kind of surrounded by the skyscrapers in New York. It's a really wonderful view, and the eagles are just, you know, beautiful. You see pictures and you look at them from the ground, but kind of being up close and personal with them and, you know, getting to show a little love is a really, really neat experience.
Now, when people travel internationally, quite often Rome is mentioned, and you mentioned it at the outset of our discussion, but Paris comes next or maybe first. What about Paris attracts you?
So Paris is just the most amazing place I've ever been to. There is a huge shadow world underneath the left bank. There's 170 miles of abandoned quarry tunnels that run, you know, beneath the Jardin de Luxembourg, beneath, you know, some of the most famous landmarks of Paris, right beneath the Sorbonne, right beneath the Saint-Sulpice Church. And it's just incredible that you can go to this city that has so much history and so much culture and is, you know, everybody knows Paris, everybody has been there or wants to go there, and 50 feet below your feet, there's an entire other city to be discovered. it's just an incredible thing. You can spend days, and I have spent days, in the underground of Paris and not see everything down there.
What about London?
London's cool. London doesn't have that same network like Paris does. It's a different city. But I've been to London a lot. London is, I'm trying to think of the kind of stuff I've done in London, and it's cool because it's this blend of the old and the new. They have a lot of new skyscrapers going up, and I've been fortunate enough to get on top of a couple of them. But London is one of those places that takes a very long time to get to know. It's just so huge and diverse and complicated that I could spend the rest of my life there and not figure it all out.
It's apparent you have an affinity for New York City that rivals that of Woody Allen. You say New York's a Jewish city.
It is. It's a cultural thing. There's a lot of people. New York has had a great variety of immigrants from different areas around the world that have come here. And if you ask, say, someone from the Caribbean, is New York a Caribbean city, they'll probably say yes. Or if you ask somebody from Eastern Europe, is New York kind of a Eastern European city, they'll say yes. And if you ask somebody from Italy, is New York kind of an Italian city, they'll say yes. So, I happen to be Jewish, so that's a character that's really easy for me to see. But it's an interesting thing, and the wonderful thing about New York City is it's kind of a home away from home for a lot of different people around the world in a cultural sense. It's one of those really interesting things that lends a lot to the city, I think.
You went to Egypt. How was that?
Mm-hmm. So I actually went to Egypt twice. I went the first time before the revolution, and I went specifically to try to go climb the Great Pyramid, which I did not do. I just kind of bottled it. I just kind of chickened out. Story's in the book, actually. I shouldn't give away the ending. You should read the book. But then I went back a month and a half ago and actually did climb the pyramid. So it was interesting. It was, we went, we figured out a way to do it. I kind of tweeted the photo, and all of these crazy Russian kids decided they wanted to do it, and the next thing I know, there's photos of them on, like, Gawker about climbing the pyramid, and it's, it become quite a stir. But, all of these things, when you're exploring cities, you're never the first and you're never the last, These are human-made structures, so you're not really almost all the time discovering anything, new like you would, you're not walking to the South Pole or anything, or climbing Mount Everest. It's a kind of a personal discovery. That's the point.
We're talking with Moses Gates. He's an urban planner, lives in New York City. His book is Hidden Cities. He's been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, and he is a man of the world. No European experience is complete without a trip to Amsterdam. You've gone there. You talk about it, mm-hmm. or write about it. How was that experience?
So Amsterdam is a cool city. It's a really fun city to be a tourist in and just kind of wander around and see. There was a church that was covered in scaffolding, and we were feeling just a little bit frisky and decided to climb up and get the view from the church. And then later I discovered it was called the Moses Hoos, which is my name, Moses. So it was kind of like I have a little special connection with Amsterdam now, I think, to some extent. But, yeah, it's a great city. Also Antwerp, which is actually in Belgium, not in Holland, but is also a Dutch-speaking city, is a really cool town with a really interesting underground. They had carved these things called ruines, which were originally for the defense of the city. They're canals that got turned in, that have served a variety of functions over thousands of years. They've got turned into navigation and then drains, sewers, and they're really beautiful. They're hundreds of years old, and I was fortunate enough to get to attend a party in one of them one time. That was a lot of fun. So Antwerp is really the city for the underground. They also have a huge metro system that was built but not used yet, so there's a lot of stuff there.
And in June of 2009, you went to Moscow.
Yes.
Did you like that?
I loved Moscow. Moscow has beautiful legal underground, actually. They had these subway stations that look like Versailles. They're just absolutely gorgeous. I spent the scariest moment of my life in Moscow, though, when I popped out of a underground river right across the street from Red Square and encountered three government police with machine guns. That was no fun, but it ended up okay. But, you know, every once in a while, you just start asking yourself, like, what in the world am I doing? But, you know, those are the moments that make life fun.
And you also
you don't want too many of them, but you want a couple.
Well, sure. You write about going to the Ukraine.
Yeah, the Ukraine is an interesting place. I spent most of my time in the Ukraine in Odessa, which actually for your listeners, Odessa and New Orleans are very similar, not in a architectural sense so much, but just in the character of their cities. Like I love New Orleans, and it's one of my favorite cities in the world because, you know, even though it's not like a huge metropolis like New York, it still has the as much character as New York has, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it. And so, you know how, like, you're in the South and, you know, a lot of times folks from New Orleans are like, oh, yeah, New Orleans has the best food, the best music, you know, kind of the best of everything in the United States. That's kind of how Odessa is with Eastern Europe. Like, if you go to Odessa, even though it's a small city, it's not a huge metropolis, it's not the capital, if you go there, you know, it's obvious that just the best of everything is in Odessa. The best writers are from there, the funniest comedians are from there, the baddest gangsters are all from Odessa. So it's just kind of has an outsized stamp on the region, kind of the same way New Orleans does, I would say.
Well, New Orleans, is, as you know, is a unique city. Yep. Not are many American cities like it. New York's probably the closest, or maybe we should say New Orleans is like New York. But at one point in your odyssey in the United States, you write about the song from Woody Guthrie, the legendary song, "This Land yep. is Your Land," floating through your brain. What was going on mm-hmm. at that point?
So "This Land is Your Land" is a song by Woody Guthrie. He's one of my favorite musicians of all times. And they teach you one verse in school, and they don't teach you all the other verses. There's a whole lot of them. Same with the Star-Spangled Banner. The Star-Spangled Banner has a whole lot of other verses to it. And one of the verses in the Woody Guthrie song is about going along, and there's a no trespassing sign. And on the other side of the sign, though, it didn't say anything, and that's the sign that's made for you and me. And it kind of spoke to me as somebody who really believes that democratic access to our country and our city is an important thing, you know. We have all of these wonderful landmarks and natural resources, or not natural resources, but natural parks and places, and, you know, people should be allowed to experience them for themselves. It's something I kind of firmly believe. So, you know, we have, like, the Chrysler Building, for instance, that we talked about earlier. It's this gorgeous building, has a beautiful view, beautiful abandoned observation deck. They should figure out a way to open it up and make it accessible again. And I kind of really believe that for everywhere.
Well, lastly, as we go south of the border, there's no doubt you have an affinity for Rio de Janeiro.
Rio is a gorgeous city. It is God's country in every way.
What about it that is so appealing to you?
So Rio is so amazing because there is no way there should be a city there. Imagine if you just took a random mountain range and decided to try to plunk a city down on it, and that's kind of what Rio is. Geographically, it is not an urban area. It's a natural area. It has mountains and rainforests and things like that in it. So, like most cities, coastal cities, like New Orleans even, or Mobile is a better example, actually, for the listeners, get their start because of their harbor. You have a good harbor, it brings commerce, and that's how a city gets its start, and that's how Rio got its start, and how New York got its start also, for that matter. But if the area surrounding this harbor is not conducive to urban development, it's not flat and easily navigable, you get some really interesting towns. You get New York, which is just a series of marshy islands, and somehow we made a city out of this, despite having to cross rivers all the time and being really constrained that way. And Rio, which has, you know, mountains growing out of the middle of it, also somehow managed to find a way to make themselves a city. And it's just beautiful. If you ever And they have an airport right in the middle of downtown. If you ever go to Brazil, take the local trip from Sao Paulo to Rio from the two local airports, not the international airports, and it is the most spectacular flight of your life. You flying into the middle of Rio is an experience that everybody should have.
Well, before we go, your favorite South American city, would that be Rio?
No, it would actually be Sao Paulo, I think. Sao Paulo is, doesn't get enough love, I feel like. It's this really great, interesting, huge metropolis with a lot of great stuff and really great people. And, you know, it never gets the love that Rio gets or Buenos Aires gets or towns like that. So, no, I would say Sao Paulo. I'm a big city fan, and Sao Paulo is a big city. And that's kind of my place I like to go. Plus, they have a lot of observation decks.
Your favorite bridge?
People ask me, this is going to sound weird, people ask me that, and I tell them it's like trying to name my favorite child. It's just, you know, I love them all for different reasons. There's a bridge in Scotland, the Firth of Forth Rail Bridge, which is an incredible structure. It was built before we really kind of knew what we were doing with bridge engineering. So was the Brooklyn Bridge, actually. And when we built these structures, we weren't taking any chances. We reinforced them every which way from Sunday because we were, you know, we didn't have computers, we didn't have architectural engineering so much. We weren't taking any chances, so we made them real strong. So the Firth of Forth Bridge is like this giant jungle gym of a steel cantilevered structure that's just incredible. And getting to climb around that's a lot of fun. So, you know, don't tell the other bridges. I might say the Firth of Forth Bridge.
Well, the book is Hidden Cities, Travels to the Secret Corners of the World's Great Metropolises, a Memoir of Urban Exploration by Moses Gates. Publishers Weekly says, urban exploration with Gates makes for wildly entertaining reading, whereas most travel authors highlight the museums, fashionable streets, and restaurants of the great cities of the world. Gates revels in surmounting contrived barriers, whether in New York, Paris, or Ukraine, a solidly entertaining ride. Congratulations, Moses Gates.
Thanks, and thanks for having me on. And I hope to get back to New Orleans sometime.
Well, we look forward to seeing you in Louisiana. Thank you, Moses.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. We did wish to note that Saturday was the 44th anniversary of the first landing on the moon, July 20th, 1969. Neil Armstrong was the man.
I'm going to step off the landing. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Millions of people watch worldwide on television. Armstrong's mission and safe return are widely considered to be among America's greatest accomplishments of the 20th century. He was joined on the mission by Michael Collins and Buzz Aldrin. Armstrong was a Navy fighter pilot in the Korean War. He flew 78 combat missions. He died last August. At 82, he was buried at sea in the Atlantic Ocean off Florida's eastern coast. And Sunday, yesterday, marked the 55th anniversary of the birth of Ricky Stockner, who produced this show until 2007. He died on February 2nd of that year at the age of 48. We miss Ricky Stockner, but we do the show every day from the Ricky Stockner Studios. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633, your number, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Michael Gurian, a renowned marriage and family counselor and the New York Times bestselling author of 26 books. He co-founded the Gurian Institute in 1996, speaks at hospitals, schools, community agencies, corporations, and churches, and consults with physicians, criminal justice personnel, and other professionals. And he is with us to talk about his latest work, The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, Dr. Gurian. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you.
So, after 50, what happens?
Well, you know, there's a whole second lifetime, actually. I start the book by talking about how miraculous it is, and we're just catching up to it. Just over 100 years ago, the average lifespan or life expectancy was 49 years old. And now, you know, depending on whether you're male or female, it's late 70s, early 80s. So, we've basically gained a second lifetime here. And that's what this book's about. As I was working with clients and also myself getting older, I realized that there wasn't a tool for helping people to stage. You know, we were just kind of getting older. We're getting older and then we become elderly. But I really wanted to see if there were stages. So I looked at brain science. I looked at biochemistry, anthropologically, and blue zones where people are living to 100, looking at the stages they're living. And I was able to develop this three-stage model, so 50 to 65, 65 to 80, 80 onward. And that became the core of the book.
You call the years 50 to 65 the age of transformation. What do you mean?
Everybody, and this is pretty cross-cultural, everybody goes through an internal process of menopause or andropause, right, depending on your sex. So there is an internal transformative process that nature is putting us through. And the age of transformation is about becoming conscious of it. So so for men and for women, and then just for human beings, to become conscious. Everyone I studied, all our interviews, focus groups, the Gurian Institute focus groups, and all the surveys, they all came back with people reporting a number of things in the transformation. One is they were trying to become elders. They didn't have language for it yet, but they knew they were transforming from just being an adult, you know, to becoming something else. And some of it is also because their kids grow up or they're in a second marriage, you know, and they want to do that differently. So they're transforming that. They're also transforming toward lower stress. By 65, nearly everyone had to decrease their stress. So de-stressing became huge just for survival. And then freedom. People talked a lot about freedom, that we're transforming toward some kind of freedom, and they needed help defining what that was. And often they would say the freedom to be myself. You know, they were trying to finally do that in their 50s and 60s. So those are some core concepts there.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757 for Dr. Michael Gurian. His book is The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. How did the genders differ after turning 50 years old?
Yeah, I have a chapter, really about a chapter and a half on that, and it's fascinating. Some of the gender differences that people will have noticed previously still exist. Some of them harden, and some of them soften. So I'll give an example of each. A gender difference that people may have always noticed is that women tend to use more words for things that are sensorial, like color, you know, things you smell, things you taste. And that's robust across the world, actually. In general, women have more words for sensorial, and women have more words for emotions, the variety of emotions they're feeling at a given moment. Well, that's a difference that stays pretty solid. However, and one part of it hardens. One part that hardens is that men lose even more memory more quickly than women for sensorial and emotional things. So that hardens. In other words, that difference gets hardened by the time they're 70. They have even less access to that information. But one thing that softens in that area is emotion. Men, as they get older and as they move through andropause and testosterone goes down and the brain shifts and transforms, men open up a lot of emotions they didn't have before. So, for instance, they'll have emotions with grandkids that they couldn't access with their kids. They'll cry more, have more tearing up, and have more immediate, visceral, and beautiful emotional responses. So it's sort of three things happening at once. Some differences stay, some harden, some soften.
Okay. You write that there is healthy intimacy as we age, and there is unhealthy intimacy. What's the distinction?
Well, yeah, that chapter, first half on intimacy, second half on sexuality, and they're both huge. Sexuality is a big deal, and it does shift. And then intimacy shifts toward more separateness. And that's actually very healthy. Couples that try to move through these stages of life and still try to be as sexually, physically, and emotionally intimate as they were when they were 30 or 40, those couples will tend to fail. It's very interesting. And it's the psyche, as the psyche individuates, as we go, we become more individual and free to be who we are, you know, between 50 and 65 and onward, our psyches are actually trying to become somewhat emotionally separate. And so people who have been married 30 years will recognize this. If someone's been married 7 years, they may not. But if they've been married 20 or 30 years, they'll recognize that you create your own lives and that that's how intimacy actually moves into the next phase of life. So, but people who are trying for constant intimacy, like trying to force their spouses, you know, to have sex 3 times a week, if that's not a fit for him or her, those marriages get into a lot of trouble in that sort of, after the kids are grown, the sort of 20 years of marriage. And they don't make the transformation as well because the two separate selves are not allowed to flourish. So intimate separateness is what that's about.
Mm-hmm. What about codependence? Is that an issue?
Well, yes. I mean, it's definitely the basic personality disorders and those areas of issue can continue all through life. In our age now, you know, given that economic freedom is available to everyone through even through divorce, or to most people even through divorce, I find that folks who feel very codependent, like codependent with an addict, that they tend to end those marriages because they have the freedom. They feel now, the kids are generally grown, and they feel the need to separate and perhaps separate completely through divorce. So codependence can absolutely be an issue, yes.
Well, you're a marriage counselor of significance, as we know, and I think it's inevitable, as we humans are, that we have conflicts, especially with those who we love. But if you're 50 years old or past that and you've been married a long time and there have been a few bumps in the road, do things usually get better or do they get worse?
Well, they get better if one develops a healthy, intimate separateness. They do. In other words, equal balance of intimacy and separateness, they get better. A lot of these issues get worked out. The kids are grown, and we have the freedom to do this and to concentrate on it. But and at the same time, a big, you know, two things can happen. One is there's just so much built-up stuff that as the kids are teenagers or whenever it happens or after they're grown, you know, a divorce happens. And, of course, a divorce could have happened earlier. So not everything gets solved, right? I mean, being 50 doesn't mean that all our hopes are met and our dreams are met. And if we had the dream of staying married forever to that person, it may not happen. So no guarantee. But if we concentrate on balancing intimacy and separateness in a new way, a new transformative way, we have a greater chance of finding the love we always wanted. And it may be already there in our relationship. It may be we form a new relationship. But mm-hmm. at that age group, that's what's needed, balance of intimacy and separateness. And that's the best chance of doing this for another 20, 30 years.
All right. 297-5633, The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50, from New York Times bestselling author Michael Gurian. Melissa asks about older men and younger women and older women and younger men. Sometimes people in their 50s have companions or partners who are significantly younger than they. How does that work?
Yeah, all of that is within the range of normal for human development. And the only way I would get involved ever in you know, even making a comment on it, because really we're free beings and we all have the right to do what brings us joy. The only way I would get involved and comment on it is if it becomes a situation of infidelity, you know, where that invades a marriage. But otherwise, older men, younger men, older women, et cetera, it really is all good.
All good.
it's all good as long as it doesn't cause, you know, I mean, obviously, as long as it's not harming another person. I think we have to realize that biologically and neurobiologically, we are, each of us is at a different stage of life and in a different internal maturation cycle. So it's really within the range of normal that sometimes you get someone who's 15-year gap in their maturity or in their needs or in what they're looking for. And but you know, obviously if a man of 50 is getting rid of his spouse to get a younger spouse, that's what I mean. That's when I'd get involved and say, okay, watch out. But if it's all mutual, it probably is all within the range of normal.
Dr. Gurian, you say we men and women, we resolve conflict differently. How so?
Yeah, we do tend to do conflict differently. There are a number of differences. One is that males tend more toward fight or flight, and females tend more toward tend and befriend. And I'll just explain that real quick. The reason is our biochemical base. Males are testosterone dominant, and that's a fight or flight chemical. And when we get under stress, that chemical shoots up in our bloodstream and brain. So we get into a more fight or flight. So we tend to get louder or push against, or we tend to withdraw, especially if our spouse can talk a lot and remembers a lot of emotional stuff. You know, within a few minutes, we'll withdraw because we can't keep up. So fight or flight. Women are dominated by other hormones. One is oxytocin. That's a tend and befriend chemical. So when women get under stress, that bonding chemical goes up. So males go to fight or flight mode quite often, and females go to tend and befriend. Males tend to try to dominate or withdraw based on their personality, and females will tend to try to come closer. They'll tend to try to become more intimate, say more words, ask what people are feeling more. And that's a primal difference between males and females. It's robust worldwide. So I'm often coaching couples to work through that and not be surprised by that. And an example is a couple where when they get in a conflict, he just shuts down and has to withdraw because he can't verbalize. And his wife is chasing him, really chasing him through the house, saying, stop, talk to me, don't leave. And I have to get them to develop a different way of being because she's going to constantly feel rejected if she doesn't realize that his brain just shuts down. He can't get at what she wants at that moment. They have to pause, wait 10 minutes, and come back. and vice versa. I mean, you know, there's a lot of aspects to this. So that's one way in which we do conflict very differently.
You say that men and women have biochemical cycles that matter not only when we're young, but also as we get older.
Oh, yeah, and especially in the 50 to 65, in that first stage of age, the transformation stage, this biochemistry really matters. And I have helped so many marriages by helping people to see that stuff they thought was psychological, in other words, that they were somehow flawed or their partner was flawed or their marriage was flawed, that, you know, a lot of the mood stuff has to do with their biochemistry and medications they're taking around the biochemistry, even foods they're eating around their biochemistry that they're allergic to, et cetera. Far more, and I talk about this in the book, far more of what we're experiencing has to do with our biochemistry than we realize, especially 50 to 65.
As far as enjoyment of life, do we enjoy life more as we get older or do we not?
Well, that's, you know, I talk in the book about this new spirit of aging, about realistic optimism and all the science around positive thoughts and positive aging. So there's a lot of science that does show that the more we can move toward optimism and toward positive thoughts, toward purpose and meaning, you know, which bring a lot of positivity, and toward joy. I mean, it's a really good word. I have a section in there about do what gives you joy. The more we do that, the more we accomplish two things. We live longer, which is in itself an accomplishment, and two, we stave off mental illness. And this is really interesting. The more positive we are, the less likely. So the more positive we are between 50 and 60, let's say, the more we're de-stressing and the more we're finding joy and, you know, living with purpose, the more likely at 70 that we won't be struggling with mental illnesses. And that's really deep for people because we think of it as physical, but some of the longevity is the quality of life around mental illness. And so it's crucial that we de-stress and become more positive. And I give a lot of tips on how to do that.
Mm-hmm. And as I've stated a few times, you're a marriage counselor. The studies have shown that people who are married, even if it's not a great marriage, they tend to live longer than those who are single.
Yeah, yes, definitely. There's a lot of interpretations and controversy around that. My research supports that, and with the caveat that because we're all living so long, that being married could mean a divorce during the time of transformation. I mean, there is about a 35% divorce rate in that 50 to 65 age group, and most of those are instigated by women, about 63%. So it's both. And then there can be a remarriage. You know, so it's marriage is not what it was 100-150 years ago. It around 30-40% of people may be married twice or more. So putting that into the mixer, it still does show that if you can be happily married, if you can get along and be married, you're going to tend to live longer with less mental illness. And the primary reason we think is that being married in a joyful way, obviously a way that serves you, builds cells up. You know, there's epigenesis.
Okay, we got to roll, Dr. Gurian. Great book, The Wonder of Aging. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.